Thank you so much for joining us, Robert.
Pleasure.
Now, a little over a month ago, you published an article called Orwell's 1984 and How It Helps Us Understand Tyrannical Power Today. This book was written 4 years after the end of World War II, and it was kind of ahead of its time then. Would you say it's still ahead of its time, of our time now?
I'm not sure if it was ahead of its time then or now. I think he was ahead of his time as a thinker, and what he did as a fairly straightforward thinker and black and white thinker was to look around and see the world as he saw it in 1948, and he saw the beginnings of the Cold War between the West and the Warsaw Pact countries beginning to sort of establish itself, and he saw the end of the war, in the World War, and its establishment, the peace, becoming a sort of tenuous peace and an impoverished peace across much of the world. Those were the sorts of things he wrote into 1984. And he saw power being contested. He saw poverty. He saw bleak times. And that bleakness, that poverty, that power contestation between East and West, I think, were the basis of what he was writing about in a very different way in 1984, predicting or projecting that forward to a notional 1984, because when the book was published, it was 1948. The publisher just says, just turn it to 1984, and we can use that as a sort of a catch, a little hook to get people interested in the book.
Well, that's a fun little fact there, just to switch the numbers around.
Yeah.
Well, Orwell coined a lot of terms in 1984 that I guess we still use today. There's Big Brother, thought crime, double speak, among many others, and they all fall under the language of news speak. So with fake news being an in thing now, how does news speak apply to today's political climate?
Well, news speak in the book was Orwell's own sort of little idea about how power is transmitted through words and how it can be manipulated through words. And newspeak was the new language introduced by the so-called English Socialist Party, who were the party in charge of the country, or the Oceania, where he lived in the book, Orwell's character in the book. And newspeak was a new way of speaking that everyone had to get used to. And the authorities thought newspeak would maybe be complete in two or three generations, where everyone begins to learn a new language. And through that new language, people forget what the old language used to mean. And through the effect of that forgetting, forget what the past was about, and so on. So in Orwell's book, it was a way of sort of controlling people through thinking, or getting them to think in new ways prescribed by the authorities themselves. So newspeak was new words, and often truncated words. And again, Orwell was looking around in the 1930s and so on. So-called Politburo, for example, in Russia was short for Political Bureau. The Nazi Party was short for National Socialism. So at that time, people were truncating or compounding words in ways that he just took to another level. And instilled it and inserted it into the language itself. And we see it today. So-called alt-right is a way of just using a kind of newspeak to think about a particular rising political phenomenon. I mean, that's okay to a degree, but what I think it also does is obscure what alt-right, for example, is. It becomes just a sort of little compound word. And there are many of those in our language today, and they're growing faster, I think, with each year.
Absolutely. I mean, like, kind of giving something that's existed for years a new word kind of takes it away from the values that they hold very similarly to a group that already exists. So
I think that's right. Yeah. I've been doing that with politicians themselves. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been noticing this for years, that we now call politicians by their first name, or we give them sort of diminutives like ScoMo.
Like ScoMo, yeah.
Which is, you know, it sounds sort of endearing, almost like a sort of teddy bear or something.
Yeah, and, I hate it.
I'm not keen myself. But what it does is sort of obliterate or erase the person himself, who may be not the teddy bear that we think that the name ScoMo itself might suggest to some people.
Yeah,
but we do it all the time. And that's again, it's a sort of a kind of newspeak that we it's slipped into all facets of language, I think, today.
Yeah, well, much of the novel kind of revolves around what you just mentioned, what we were just talking about, like political manipulation through words. So how does the power of words kind of translate into today's online digital world?
Well, words are and meaning has always been fungible. But I think if you think back to how we used to read or come to words, it was mainly through print. And through face-to-face conversation. And so face-to-face conversation would be with a narrow group of peers, friends, and so on, maybe a few hundred people in our lifetime at most, and we would sort of speak the same language and use over and over and over the same words. The same with print and newspapers and books. We would be quite narrow, really, relatively speaking, our choice and selection of print culture artifacts. So the words and their meanings stayed fairly simple. It's not simple, stable. They would change, of course, but they would change slowly and change over quite a long period of time. But translate that to the digital, it massively expanded in terms of the choices we have in terms of reading, people to speak to through either face-to-face or through the network itself. And so because of that sort of scaled-up size of our relationship to words, the meanings themselves have so many now different potentialities. So meaning gets lost or it gets quickly changed into something else. So meaning loses its grip or its tether to what might have been more stable realities in a previous generation or previous generations brought up on print culture.
Yeah, of course. Well, my partner and I were actually having a conversation about this the other day. In 2016, Oxford Dictionary named post-truth as its word of the year, which defined the term as when objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and popular belief. Do you think we live in a post-truth world?
Well, the idea of truth has always been sort of something argued about or debated by philosophers, but most of us think that there's some objective truth which lies somewhere, which is all we have to do is find it. And that's how, you know, life becomes sort of stable and tethered to something which we feel is real. So truth we feel or like to feel is out there somewhere. But the idea of post-truth or the idea that there's other truths is again, quite an old one and something that Orwell was quite sort of familiar with. He fought in the Spanish Civil War, for example, from 1936 to 1937, and he at the front line saw what it was like there, and he fought for the nationalists against the Republicans, and he was shot through the throat and he was, you know, shipped home to England. But what he read about the war in Spain, in England, bore no reality to his experience of the war. So he knew how truth could become redundant through its mediation. And again, thinking back to his time, what the Nazis did with propaganda through radio, for example, they could bend and shape truth in all sorts of ways which suited the Nazi party. Again, scale it up to our own time in the internet and how there are so many contesting truths online that we seemingly have to find the real one within the contenders, but it's impossible because there are so many disputed facts, so many narratives which contest the reality of this or that issue. So the idea of post-truth, I think, is here, but it's always been here, but the internet or the web makes it much more difficult to find if there is such a thing as truth.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so, so much for joining us, Robert. It's been really fantastic having you on the show to talk about this.
It's a pleasure.